Greetings, this is Stephen Merritt, and I am apparently on WGXC Accra, which I think of as WGXC Hudson, but I don't know. I've never been to Accra.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
What's the situation, Captain?
This is Cheryl Kay, host of Situation Fluxus on WGXC, 90.7 FM, listener-supported radio for open ears in upstate New York. The show is a weekly one-hour program focused on jazz and improvised music, news, radio, conversations, and more that airs on Thursdays at 10 a.m. and Fridays at 4 a.m. To contact us about Situation Fluxus, thejazzdisturbance@gmail.com or info@wgxc.org. Keep tuned in to 90.7 FM, wavefarm.org/listen, tune in, and on the Wavefarm radio app on your smartphone. Our website is wgxc.org.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Bob Wills Architecture of Rhinecliff, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. Become a WGXC sustaining supporter today. Go to wgxc.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
Good evening, and welcome to Race Talks, where we have the very necessary conversation on race and ethnicity. And we are also here to answer the question, why talk about race? It's simply to combat racism. Education is a key and discussion a must. The bottom line is that you'll find us keeping it real here on Race Talks, where
no topic is taboo.
Awesome. That voice is of my guest, speaker, and talker, young adult author, Gerald L. Hoover. But before we get into our discussion with my very wonderful guest, I do want to pay homage to this month, which is Black History Month. Today, we have a special monologue that is a really good way of opening tonight's topic, which is race and self-expression. So I'm going to introduce this recitation with my assistant here, Ms. Kelly Greer. And this is my anonymous person, but we've decided to title it, I Am Black, and very quickly you will know why. Are we ready?
Yes.
Awesome. Take it away.
I am Black. I said, I'm Black. I announced to the world that I'm Black, and immediately the world is shocked. But what's there to be shocked about? The truth is the truth. I know what you say about Black. Black cows give no milk. Black chickens lay no eggs. Black cake is the devil's food. Yeah, I know what you say about Black. But see, that's the beauty of it all. That we are people from Africa who've been called niggers, colors, and Negroes can take a name that was so ugly and turn it into something of pride. When Stokely Carmichael stood in Greenwood, Mississippi and declared that we need Black power, Negroes were shook with their hair stratified, shook at the thought of being called Black. But I am Black.
Thank you. I'm going to give what my students do in the classroom with fingers. That was awesome.
Thank you.
I like this poem because it does bring up history. Stokely Carmichael, right? The idea that Black in that terminology isn't right. And that we actually have words for, you know, if you're Black, get back, right? So it's a different stance and viewpoint than what we're going to be talking about here. But that's why Black History Month is so important, because it keeps alive our history. And to know where we are today and to be able to feel really confident about ourselves, we need to know our history. We need to know about the people who have come before us. That's really important. And that's why I'm so glad to have on the show tonight Gerald L. Hoover, who is the published author of a young adult title, My Friend, My Hero. It's actually one of four in his hero book series that he targets towards young Black and brown boys ages 12 and up. Blackboard African American Booksellers honors it, putting Hoover on a short list of African American male young adult authors that includes Walter Dean Myers, Kevin Powell, Kwame Alexander, whom I've met personally, and Ralph Burgess, along with Jason Reynolds, all great authors. Hoover is celebrating his series commemorative edition that includes his addendum of book discussion questions and makes them available in a full curriculum to include student success guidebook, teacher's guide, and unit assessments that contains lesson plans with the sole goal to promote social and emotional learning in the classroom, which is wonderful for teachers because oftentimes teachers do not have time to fully engage with the text, creating their own materials. So to have a book of this type to be given to teachers to help guide them through the book with their students is wonderful. So I'm glad that this commemorative edition is out, and he's going to talk to you more about it. He is also a parent. He also offers workshops for students, parents, and other professionals in the development for the understanding of race and ethnicity as it pertains to African Americans and others who are not of white ancestry. So may I say to Gerald, welcome, and can you share a little bit more, maybe even some more private personal things about yourself and how in fact you got into the desire or had the desire to write this book and continue with your series?
Well, thank you for having me, Kimberly, and everyone out there. I'm happy to be here and say happy Black History Month. I can say that. Happy Black History Month, even though there's something that should be done every month, every week, every day. But I know we have February, so we celebrate that on another level. So like I said, happy Black History Month. My journey into the foray of writing started when I was actually 8 years old, when I wrote a book called I Was a Sad Boy. And the reason why I wrote that book was because my mom and dad were going through a divorce, and I was sad. I was sad about them getting divorced, but I think I was even more sad that my dad wasn't around, because he had a problem. Drugs and alcohol had reared his ugly head, and he was a Vietnam vet, and some stuff going on. You know, he was 60s. You know, he was born in the 40s, but he was a 60s man. And if we took me to my history, Stokely Carmichael's and different things like that you just mentioned. And our young people today was to actually go through history to see how turbulent it was in the 60s, they would shake their head and marvel at how any Black man or any man of color even made it through. Because I think the 60s was probably the most turbulent time of our history, I believe. Aside from slavery time, I'm talking about just the 60s itself was just very turbulent time for the country. But Black America has really suffered in a lot of ways. But I started writing again when I was in third grade. I was 8 years old. I didn't know at the time that writing was actually giving me relief, right? Because I had a stuttering problem. I still do, right? I talk fast. Wow. Oh yeah, but I'm a motivational speaker. Go figure, right? But I have a stuttering problem. But back then, I spoke really, really bad, right? Really fast, stuttered. So I had, you know, some insecurities in our speaking, naturally. But I wasn't necessarily a shy person. Just that, I guess I was like a person that wanted to run, but the leg was broken. You know, he wanted to run, but had to wait for the leg to heal before he was able to get out and run. But so again, writing helped give me relief. So I didn't try to get the book published because I was just writing just to get things out of my head. But then when I was in the 13th grade, I say that because I had to repeat ninth grade, not because I was dumb, not because, I mean, I don't use the word dumb, not because I wasn't intelligent enough to pass classes, but I was truant, all right? I didn't go to class. I just had issues, emotional issues, going through stuff, and I didn't really go to school. And the days I did go to school, like say I may miss Monday through Wednesday, find out that I got a test on Thursday and get an 85 or something like that on the test. But it wouldn't pass because I wasn't in class long enough. I mean, enough. So I repeated the ninth grade, but I stayed in high school an extra year, which was actually a blessing in disguise. Why? Because that is when my friend, my hero, came into my life. And not only that, had I graduated in 1983, I would have only been 17. And so I wasn't emotionally ready to graduate and go to college or anything like that. I would probably be sitting around trying to figure it out. So I was able to graduate at 18, which gave me more emotional stability, I believe. But the blessing, again, like I said, was that's when my friend, my hero, came into play. Now, that summer of 1983, I wrote a speech. And the speech was geared to other 17-year-olds, 17, 18-year-olds. And the premise of that speech was to help young men and women to not do drugs, stay off drugs, stay off alcohol, go to school, you know, just live and be someone. But we had no platforms back then by which speeches can go out. You know, young 17-year-old kid from the projects, what are you going to do with a speech? And of course, like again, like we didn't have blogging and blogs, and you know, we didn't even have fax machines that were like of any consequence.
I think so, you're showing your age.
Well, I'm gonna be proud to say this. I'm 56 years old. Okay,
I'm laughing because I just celebrated mine this Saturday. Yay! And I'm just a few years younger.
I love it. But you know, so funny. Get off topic really quick. If I go to the gym and get on that treadmill, I'm not a big weightlifter, but anything as far as stamina and running around, them young boys can't handle me. I might not run as fast, but I run just as long, right? But anyway, that's because of mind over matter. But back to what I was saying, I was on a basketball court, right? This is after the speech was written, and I had this like premonition of a basketball player from Mount Vernon and naming him Bennett Wilson, name this player, this fictional character, and allow the character to give the speech, right? And that name, I don't even know why I came to that name. It was just amazing to me. And I had to have a friend, you know, because I wanted the book to be about friendship and making choices and making the right choices and so forth and so on. So I had the makings of the story in my head, right? So this is now this is when the summertime. And so I don't start writing until October 17th, 1983. So I let all of this stuff just fester in my spirit, and every day, it was in my mind, write this book, the characters. I mean, I was just thinking of scenes. It was amazing, the transfer of wisdom and knowledge and information that was coming to me, right? Now, the problem now is I want to write this book, but I don't have anything to write with. I didn't have a typewriter. Now, I said typewriter. Like you said, I'm showing my age. I have a typewriter, and we definitely didn't have computers back then.
A word processor.
There you go. and if I'm not mistaken, they would have been as big as that bookshelf, right? Right. So get one of them in your house. Is like, good luck with that.
But, remember we're radio. So you're pointing to your large.
I forgot. But I see you. So my bad. Okay. But it would have been as big as a refrigerator. I'll say like that. But so I didn't have a data processor, I didn't have a typewriter. But what I did have was an ironing board and a pen and a notebook. You say, what? Yep. The first 9 drafts were written by hand.
Oh.
I kid you not. Kimberly, when I think about it now, some almost 40 years after the fact, I'm like, how in the world did I do that? Meaning, I bought a spiral notebook, and I didn't buy those 50 sheet ones or 100 sheet ones. I bought the 200 sheet ones and above, or 250. And I literally would write, because I had to write double space. So I would write the book out, okay? And then I had a cousin, I have a cousin that was my mentor, big brother, if you want, father figure even. And I asked him, could he oversee it? You know, just write it and edit it and see where I went wrong. Now, let me tell you a quick story. I wrote the first draft without reading a full book, right?
Explain that. Without reading a full book.
I'm so glad you asked that. This is, and Radio Land, please listen to this, because I don't want you to try this at all. Because I was such a good writer. You know, I could put things together. Right? My mind was always sharp. I was able to write poetry without even being trained. I was able to write love letters. I used to write love letters for my friends, you know, that like certain girls. You know, I write love. I write
like Cyrano de Bergerac.
There you go.
And actually, there's a new movie out about that. And one of the main characters, Cyrano, I think it's Cyrano, it's an African-American male.
Oh, I love it. I got to see that, please. I got to look that up. Because I'm going to look at that and smile. But I'll write letters for him, write poetry. And, you know, and when it came out to book reports, of course, I would go to the thickest book on the shelf that had the inner notes. And I just read them, change words around. And all of a sudden, I get A's and B's. I did that basically my whole entire school year, right? And because the writings were so easy, but I did read though, because I read magazines, newspapers, because I went to church, so I read the Bible, even though I didn't understand it. I read verses, but I just read a lot, but I didn't read books. And so when it came down to writing this book, what I wanted to do, this is the craziest thing. My goal was to write a great book and be able to go on television and brag that I never read one.
That's not good. As a person who tries to get students to read a lot, I wouldn't want that.
but Cam, here's the funny thing. That's almost like a chef trying to hawk his restaurant, his or her restaurant, and saying, hey, come eat, you know, my restaurant. By the way, I can't stand food. I don't eat. Exactly. You know what I mean? That would be like, okay, you don't like food. You want me to come eat your restaurant? When I think about it now as a 56-year-old man, to think about how I was at 17, 39 years ago, I'm like, dude, you was nuts to even think that way. So now I'm going to tell you what.
But I actually like that you're mentioning that, because I do think that people grow, right? So you're not obviously the same person you are in school. And there's peer pressure in school. So to express yourself, and I'm going to use that term quite a bit because that's the topic of today's show, race and self-expression. To be able to express yourself, you have to be very comfortable with who you are.
Comfortable in your own skin. I love it. It's exactly right. And so, and matter of fact, I'm glad you're saying that, because here's where it really gets heated. So I wrote this draft. I wanted to brag about me not being a reader. Well, again, it sounds just nuts when I think about it. So I let my cousin take a look. I told him about it. I said, hey, man, I'm trying to write a book. You know, what you think about looking at it? And, you know, so I saw him at church. It was a Sunday. I gave it to him, gave him the script. I mean, I gave him the notebook. Now, again, I wrote the whole notebook from cover to cover, double space. Again, don't ask me how I did it, because I couldn't even tell you. So he says, okay, give me a couple of weeks, and I'll let you know. So another week went by, you know. I see him at church. He said, well, next week I'll let you know. And then I see him the following week. He says, I'm going to call you. Now, mind you, I'm thinking like, he's going to tell me, man, you're going to be on Oprah soon. And you're going to be on Johnny Carson, right? Merv Griffin, of course. Now, I'm re-dating myself now, for real, right?
I was going to say, well, you are on Race Talk, so there you go.
Dinah Shore and all that kind of, I mean, I'm thinking about.
Dinah Shore.
I know. Don't judge me, okay? I'm older than you, right? So don't judge me. No, but I'm thinking like, all these shows I'm gonna be on, that was daytime back in those days, you know? And so I'm psyched out. I'm like, okay, wait, I can't wait till you call me. He says, I'm gonna call you at 8 o'clock. make sure you answer the phone. But you know, remember 83, we didn't have call waiting, right? So if somebody called you and somebody was on the phone, line was busy. So I'm patrolling the phone like a security guard. So my sister can't use it, or my little sister can't use it. My sister Tracy, my mother Hilda could not use the phone. No, don't touch it. So phone rings, I pick it up quick. What's up? And he said, you sitting down? And I'm like, what are you sitting down for? I mean, I'm like, why did you sit down? Just tell me how great the book is so I can, you know, get my suit ready. And man, Kimberly, for about a half hour straight, I mean, he tore me a new one. He tore me a new one, sewed it back up, and tore it again. He didn't call me dumb or stupid. Yeah, it wasn't about that. But he was like, man, you don't read books. You don't do this. You don't do. I mean, he eviscerated me, right? Because he can tell that I didn't read books. Why? Because little fundamental stuff like indenting, where a person is, after they have a novel description, you have dialogue, and you put the dialogue in quotations. And I mean, it was just so many fundamental things that was just straight out of the loop. And I still, as a matter of fact, I got to ask him this. I'm still trying to figure out, what did he see that was so good for him to tell me, you got to read 5 books, right? And I'm going to test you on each book. So you don't try to be slick with me, like, you know, like you do whatever with the book reports or whatever. I don't know how he knew, but whatever it was. He said he's going to ask me questions, right?
Well, he probably knew because he probably was like that.
He's more of a boy G's, but he might have been like that. But I guess he knew how slick I was because he can tell that I wasn't reading, okay? I mean, like, what I did fundamentally was just so out of whack. So long story short, he sells me 5 books. Now, I remember at the time I had a girlfriend that looked like Holly Berry. I mean, she was.
I don't know if the story's short. I think we're going to have to get to your books and what they're about.
No, I will, because this tells you that. So I have to tell her, look, I can't see you anymore. I mean, I can't see you for a little while because I got to read books. So I picked out 5 books. Miss Jane Pittman, Outsiders, Rumblefish, This Was Then and That Was Now, and another one. Can't remember the other one then. But I read all 5 books in 10 days. And instead of him asking me questions, he's giving back. Now, I'm reading these books like I'm trying to study them as if I'm studying for a test. He never asked me a question. He just gave me back the manuscript and said, here, rewrite it. Now, I'm kind of pissed at him now because I'm like, I studied for like I was going to be tested. You didn't test me. I rewrote the book. All of a sudden, I can tell how better I was. So I went from like maybe a grade 2.5 to like a grade 7. And I could see how the flow and how things were supposed to be put together. And that's kind of what made me think, in order for you to be a better reader, I'm a better writer, you got to be a better reader. Because there's certain things that opens up the brain to allow you to think, function, and process properly. And so now, but that gives me even more insight on how I write my books. Right. So My Friend, My Hero became a book of choice, peer pressure, being comfortable in your own skin, why you should do things the right way, and how you can sort of germinate that to help other people. Right. So now when I wrote My Friend, My Hero, it took me, after I got the book in typewriter form, right? I finally got it in typewriter form in 1984. From 1984 to 1992, I got rejected 42 times. Because I was trying to get the book published. Yeah, because at that time, they weren't publishing young black authors. Now, I was always told by every publisher and editor and agent how good the book was. It was timely, thought-provoking. I mean, they gave me all kinds of accolades. But at the end, that bottom sentence, they would tell me that it wasn't right for their list. And I'm thinking, like, what is this they're talking about? And one day, I went to
a bookstore. They have an idea that they meant because they didn't believe that black people would buy books?
Yep. They wouldn't think they didn't think that black people would write books, and they didn't think that young black boys would read it. And now
and it wasn't in the schools. There was no curriculum.
Right. But see, now what they did for me was open a door for me. Right? What would have looked like a Red Sea moment? Mm-hmm. Seas parted. Because I said to myself, actually meeting Nikki Giovanni helped me. Because I met her in 1985, I was in Norfolk State, and she kind of gave me some words of wisdom. Even though the book didn't get published until 1992, but the things that she said to me kind of stuck with me. Even from a standpoint when she said, when your book is published, you gotta, you know, get to every microphone, every camera, every this, and just talk about your book. And when I told her that I stuttered, she told me, get over it.
I like that.
But and she, you know what? She may not even remember that, but I do. Because what she did was she spoke life and determination to me. Yes. But, and that's the only reason why I allowed myself to get rejected and kept rewriting and said, no, this book don't get published because this book, this series, this thing is bigger than me. And I can feel it because the way I wrote the book, the way the characters were, the way everything was put together, I like, this is something different. This is something different. And I felt it, Kim.
Was it your perseverance because you were involved in the character, or was it still at this time you wanted, it was all about you wanting to be someone, or really was it about the material that you really wanted to impart to others? What was the motivating factor for your perseverance?
To tell you the truth, I would have settled for being a businessman on Wall Street. I mean, I could have done it marketing because my mind was always creative, so I could have tried to do something on that level. I always listen to wear suits in school anyway, so I was always in my mind, I was a businessman. But this story, from the first draft, and when I allow people to read it, everybody knows a true story, but it wasn't. And the way I was feeling about this character, and when people were reading it saying, man, this thing can help a lot of people. When I was hearing that, even in draft form, I knew that the purpose of the book was bigger than me. And so that's what kept driving me. Then I'll say this. One day I was writing, this is a true story. It was 1984. I was writing, it was on a Saturday. And I remember I was on the 10th floor in the projects. I had all my windows open. And I can remember hearing my friends outside playing. And I looked outside and all I saw was blue skies. And I kind of said to myself, why am I doing this? Because I'm upstairs writing, you know, in a peak of the day. And like I wasn't English writing, I know when it was published, but I'm like, no promise of it. And a voice spoke to me and said, this is not just about you. Keep writing.
Excellent.
And when the voice told me that, Kim, I only had to hear it one time. I didn't go to the window. I ain't asked, Lord, that you. I didn't. The way that voice told me that, I just turned back around and kept writing. And so that's what, and for me to think about that now in 2022, I knew that what that voice was about. And then I realized that once the books were published and the people that I was going to see, because I'm going to tell you this, when the book kept getting rejected, I said to myself, I'm not going to try to go to a bookstore. When a book is published, I'm gonna put a curriculum in the back of the book. I'm gonna put essay questions and topics for discussion in the back of the book. So when it's published and go to schools, I can put it in schools. Because I had no profanity. I don't have any racial. I'm not using the N-word. I'm not doing anything like that. So I know I can at least get into a school, a church, or community-based organization. And that was my target, Kim. And this year in November, My Friend, My Hero would be out 30 years. 30 years. And I've gone to different publishers. Every publisher I had, I end up either buying them out because they couldn't afford me anymore. They couldn't handle, or they went out of business, but my books was always making money. So now I came up with my own publishing company. I've expanded the book series to where it's called the Hero Book Series, where I got My Friend, My Hero, He Was My Hero Too, A Hopeful Hero, and Hoop Hero. Those are the books for the young adults and teens, 12 and up. Then I had the blessed fortune to come up with an idea. Actually, someone told me to do it, and I came up with the concept that now I'm expanding the Hero Book Series to where I'm going to reach toddlers and bring them up. So
I like that you say that, because I actually ran into a woman in our community, which is Columbia County, Greene Counties, that's pretty much where we serve. There are obviously lots of opportunities for creative people to sell their wares, especially when it's nice and warm. But we even have something called Winter Walk, where you can also most people buy lots of food and crafts and stuff. But sometimes our authors come out, and this one woman, she actually works with young kids, you know, toddlers through Zoom with their families. So there's always, you know, young people can always learn. And like language, it's like a blank slate. So sharing information that you can impart will help them more in their self-expression. I have a question for you, really. In our show, we have different segments, and I've kind of change the segment topic because I really wanted to have you have more of a discussion. But could you read something of your book? Because we have a section called Word of Wisdom. So something that can really impart to the listeners what it is, what's inside the book that can be really helpful to young, and you mentioned young males, but I'm thinking that, you know, when it comes to self-expression and feeling good about yourself, it's across genders.
Well, I'm glad you said that. On my book covers, on purpose, I have more girls than I have boys. On purpose. So I have three girls and two boys. And when you read the book, you see a lot of female characters doing a lot of big stuff, right? From mother, sister, the girlfriend, classmate. So this is not like Boys Town, where it's a bunch of guys hanging around and just chilling out. No. There's a lot of female voices in here on purpose. And I've had girls have book clubs with it. So, My Friend, My Hero is a concept. The Hero book series is a concept because, like I said, each book has the word hero in the title for a reason. I want people to see the title and think of themselves as heroes. I want people to see the characters and on the cover and see themselves as heroes. And I want people to read the book and see themselves as, wait a minute, I know somebody like that. Or maybe they're talking about me, you know? And so it has a lot of psychological benefits to reading it.
Awesome, Gerald. As you're finding what you're going to read, I'm just going to share with the audience how I was in a school district today in a classroom. Actually, not a classroom, but the school. I don't know where it was in the school, but I saw a drawing and the words H-E-R-O-I-N. And I'm like, what? And you know, that spells heroin. And I'm like, that cannot be in the school. And then I'm like, oh, there must be a missing E somewhere. I think it was hidden by a flag or something. Your hero book. Yeah, you got to make sure you spell things correctly. Hero, yeah. Heroin.
Yes.
Heroin. Yes. Yes. Okay, so did I give you enough time to get you to that place where you
Yeah, can I'm going to give you something.
Words that, of wisdom?
Yeah, I'm going to give you something. I'm going to give you something deep. All right, you ready for this?
I'm ready.
All right. Several weeks had elapsed, and Bennett was still hanging on to life by a thread. Although the information the authorities had was thorough, there were no arrests. Bennett had been shot just above the heart, hooked up to a life pack. Every breath he took was an ordeal. The machine breathed oxygen into his nose. Miss Wilson's blood pressure skyrocketed. Her doctors advised her to not to see Bennett every day and to seek counseling. Tara's burden became heavier as each day passed. She visited the hospital only occasionally, but spent a great deal of time with the Wilsons, seeing to it that Yvette and Dannon were getting along all right. Kirby, though, went to the hospital every day and listened to his buddy babble nonsense. Bennett was out of his mind. Kirby tried having conversations with him, but it was no use. He would ramble on about himself and Dannon, Tara, Kirby, everybody. Then came the day when Bennett regained consciousness. Kirby walked in and placed Bennett's diploma by his bedside. Bennett, seeing his buddy as he focused, said in a dry and weakened voice, "Kirby, you still owe me a couple of burgers." Kirby smiled cheerfully. "Man, you don't know how glad I am to hear you say that." But when Bennett added, "Let Yvette know I'm sorry I won't be there for a birthday in October," Bennett began to get nervous. "But Bennett, the doctors say you're making great progress. Don't talk like that. I can't fight much longer. But listen, look after Mama and Tara for me." Kirby's eyes began to water. "And tell Dannon that I said it's not always how long you live, but how well. He'll know what you mean." Bennett took time to breathe as he watched tears stream down Kirby's face. He took Kirby's hand and held it as tightly as he could. "I love you, man." Kirby couldn't take it anymore. In haste, he changed the subject. "Man," he wiped his eyes, "you look great." They must have talked nonstop for hours before Bennett said he was tired and wanted to go to sleep. He never heard Kirby say goodnight. Bennett just closed his eyes and smiled. Kirby knew he'd never open them again. Rest in peace, my friend, my hero.
That is deep. I was just talking to students about Greek mythology today and how mythologies, myths, they really help guide us, give us, you know, morals, understanding our morals and values. And that Greek myth was showing how to not be prideful. And so not that this is a myth, but it's really showing how to endure with a bad situation happens.
It's what I was also doing was, and believe it or not, when I wrote, even though this book is fiction, there were more than a few scenes in there where tears came to my eyes, right? Because the what I would do as a writer, what I would do, I would use music as my muse, and how I got the ebb and flow of like how to build a story was by listening to tracks, listening to, you know, say Anita Baker or Lionel, Teddy Pendergrass, what's the big boy that passed away? I'm mad at myself when I know him. Not remember. He lives in Greenwich, Connecticut.
I think he's Sidney Poitier, but I know
I'm talking about a singer. I had a blank spot. But anyway, I would listen to somebody like Anita Baker or somebody like that, or even Dionne Warwick. I'm going old school because they would have a slow song, a fast song, a song to make you think, a song to make you mellow. And I was like, wait a minute, these tracks are like that. And then I'm noticing other people that did tracks did the same thing. Everything wasn't just fast. So I decided to say, I wanted to captivate my audience that way. So as I was writing, I would put on certain types of music to sort of put me into a certain type of mood. And if I had a scene that I knew that had to be emotional, I would put music on to drive me there. And so I would get emotional the same way people would read the book and feel emotion. And so it was easy for me to allow two young men to tell each other they loved each other. Or even like the boy with his girlfriend, if he needs to tell her something in a certain way, he can do it. And so I would put myself into that kind of mindset. And actually, people were telling me, some famous writers were telling me that I had a good ear and that I can write dialogue. And even though maybe a woman or an older man or whatever, and I sort of morph myself into that character so the words would sound like that. And so that kind of helped me, but I used music to help me drive that. So I wasn't afraid to express myself with that. And because I was trying to even look at it from a perspective that you just mentioned earlier, by peer pressure. Too many times our young boys in particular won't carry books because they're scared that people are gonna say to them, why are you acting white? Or say something like that. And so a person who was destined to be a genius will stop himself because he's scared that he won't fit in. He or she was scared that they won't fit in. While you're doing that, you're not only hurting yourself, but you're hurting the universe because you're robbing us of your genius. You know, as opposed to saying, look, I'm sorry you feel that way about yourself, about me, but this is not going to stop me from doing what I need to do, because at the end of the day, I may be in a position where I can help you one day. You know what I mean? Yeah. If everybody's doing their best, Kim, then you can help someone. What's they say? Blind leading the blind. Blind leading the blind, you're going to fall into a ditch. So somebody got to be able to see. And so there are a lot of life lessons that I try to put into each one of my books that I want people to live better. I want people to be empowered, feel empowered, feel educated, feel entertained, but also be enlightened. Because too many times they say that you want to hide something from a person of color, put in the book. That is, you know, whether it's true or not, it shouldn't even be said. You know what I mean? It shouldn't even be something that should be it shouldn't even be something that's even in our hemisphere. You know what I mean? So my thing is I want to bust that myth, right? I want it to be so that young men and women of color read books, and they read books often. They read books a lot. They write books. They express themselves as artists. They express themselves as businessmen. Another thing I look at too, Kim, is I don't see enough men my color going to corporate America wearing suits and ties.
So you're saying your color, you don't mean the hue of your color, you mean being Black?
Being Black, being Black, okay. Being Black.
We had a segment with two African-American men who one is on Wall Street, just for those reasons, to allow for, well, he had spoken at one of the schools in our community. But mm-hmm. I like the idea that you went back to self-expression, being with music and as along with writing in the art. I'm just going to read the definition for self-expression. Okay. It's the expression of one's feelings, thoughts, or ideas, especially in writing, art, music, or dance. And that means especially in those avenues. But like you said, you can be a creative businessman. I mean, there were jokes. And again, I don't even know why we call it jokes, but they were jokes about how gang members, they are very intelligent to be able to exchange quite a few hundreds and thousands of dollars in a short time frame. You know, like if you put a suit on one of them, they would be very successful, right? If you give them a few more books and took away the guns and the other negative influences, they too would be successful in a place like Wall Street. And I wanted to bring into the mix some kind of recognition of Black History Month and our music, because you said, you know, if a Black young boy or girl, but if they're caught red-handed with a book, oh my goodness, they're going to be seen as acting white. And I really want to flip that script a little, because we have music that is made, expressed by African-Americans, Black people, who some would say has been co-opted, but which has been used and shared with the world. And no one is saying that these people playing our music are acting Black. And no one's like, oh, I can't listen to that, or you can't listen to that around me because, oh, people might think you're trying to be Black. So if when they play music that is inspired and expressed by African Americans, if they're not trying to be afraid, you know, that someone might be calling them Black, we shouldn't be afraid or thought that we're becoming or trying to be white by having a book. I just want to add that this month and this year, every 4 years now, there's something called the Olympics, and the Winter Olympics is this month. And I was very surprised and very happy to see in one of my favorite sports, which is ice dancing, that in this new team competition, I think this is the second Olympics that they have a team competition when all ice dancers or figured skaters, they actually team up to win a team award, a team medal. And this year's short free skate for the dancers, the majority of the music, I think there were like six of them on the skating rink, and four or five out of the six were actually dancing to African American music on this international world stage. One was, listen this, now I'm gonna ask you if you know the musician, Brick House.
Wow, it's a Brick House?
They skated to Brick House, you can YouTube it. Yes, they did.
Wow.
So wow. Who sings Brick House? You mentioned, I think, him earlier.
Lionel Richie.
Commodores, can you imagine that? Now, of course, they did the Janet Jackson, they did the Michael Jackson, but Brick House, and it was an Eastern European skater.
They might as well went to Rumshake or something like that, or doing the butt by EU, they might as well went that way too.
But what I really want to underscore with what you mentioned is that people have utilized the expression of African Americans in many different ways, in many different venues. And yes, you know, we talk sometimes about them co-opting, but no one ever is fearful of being seen as one way or the next. I know that I was watching MSNBC and Reverend L. Sharpton mentioned that, say it loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. Who sings that?
James Brown.
Yeah. Come on, man.
Shared with him because it was like James Brown was like was like his real godfather, right? We call him the godfather. So he was actually very close to him. And he said that he had told him that when he was going to perform in these places, that he would literally, the whole band would have to get off the bus, change in the bus, get off the bus, go straight from the back of the arena into the onto the stage. And after they do a set, sweating, you know how they are, sweating funky after, you know, getting on up, they would have to then immediately leave the venue, go right back out the back, right on their bus, and that's when they had to change back into their clothes. They couldn't use any of the facilities.
But listen, Kim, and to your point, Luther Vandross was the other one I was thinking when I had that brain fog. It was Luther Vandross, okay. a lot of his music. What's mysterious is this, and you look at and check what I mean by this. Now, you just mentioned about what happened with the Olympics with the music they were using. A lot of times, they'll let us entertain them, right, with music and expression, sports, okay, cook for them, all right? But when it comes down to the intellectual part, they want us to be on the side.
Yes, and I'm going to say that I'm deeply, I want to say saddened, but I think I'm more than that when we see that because of the CRT, critical race theory conflict, although I don't know what kind of conflict you have when there's a theory and it's educationally discussed through, you know, it's not like it's some meandering thought. It's real, you know, real scholars having a conversation, deciding that this is really good information to impart on students at a, in a higher educational format. And it's not for primary school children, right? Because we don't really, you know, want to mar them with anything that they can't handle at a certain age. And like your book, Young Adult series, you have an age group and, you know, a range. I have a book for young children, and that has a range. So of course, everything has a range, but they've just now banned a book called The Bluest Eye from some school districts in, I want to say red states, but I'm sure it, you know, they could be purple too. The idea is that how is a book that's renowned, taught everywhere, now banned because it talks about a racial idea?
Because
basically, I'm just going to say, basically, The Bluest Eye is trying to share how Black people should feel really comfortable in their skin. How is that a problem?
No, because I'm going to say, when there's a threat of intellect, that's when we're going to get marginalized and pushed aside. Again, and then going back to what I was saying about, and I wish I was on with the brothers that works on Wall Street, just to even listen, because what's being taught, what's not being taught, the fact that a lot of schools don't have even a penmanship where you can learn how to sign your name, read on grade level, so that you're looking at too many people graduating high school with third and fourth, maybe fifth grade reading levels, 18, 19 years old, and can't sign their name, can't even fill out an application, don't even know that builders exist in their city, in cities, in metropolitan Manhattan, Philadelphia, Baltimore, wherever, that you can qualify for a job there if you knew what to do. But the fact that too many of us aren't doing things from an intellectual standpoint that they see, that we're not even qualified for those jobs because we won't even apply for them. But yet, when there's a tally counted, how many minorities do you have working for your company? You may say 250 out of, I don't know, 2,000, but yet they either work in a security, cleaning it, cooking for it, or delivering the mail. Now, I don't have a problem with any man having a job. God knows I don't. If you have a job doing security, that's your job, I'm with you. But my thing is, don't just lump me there. Don't let me just come in there where I can only protect the building, clean the building, deliver the mail for the building, or cook for the occupants in it. But I can't go and I can't be and have my own desk with my own secretary, you know what I mean? Or do things from that, from an intellectual perspective, that's going to help your company grow. That's not working for me.
What you're stating right now is a part of what I'm going to say, call a Q&A. But before I do that, I want to just highlight the specifics, because sometimes I mention books and things and I want to be more thorough. So The Bluest Eye was written by Toni Morrison in 1970. That was the year I was born, which is really odd. I remember The Bluest Eye in college. So it's like, look how long I had to wait to get that book. Wow. You know, I couldn't get it in high school. Mm-hmm. And Toni Morrison, much to your point, Gerald, she was the Nobel laureate in literature and of course a Nobel Prize winner. So she is the epitome of education, knowledge. And yet they are pulling her book, The Bluest Eye. So yeah, it's quite a conundrum. You go, really? I can't believe this. But like I said, I want to get back to the point you just made. I've been hearing about when you talk about athletes, how they can entertain us on the athletic field, on the stage, but not in the business realm. We can't be making deals with them. And that just is what's on the NFL agenda now, with two Black men who one was just fired from being a head coach in the NFL for the Miami Dolphins. And then you have another Black man who's taking that place of this guy that they just hired. And I think there now will be two or three.
That's what the Texans. Lovie Smith is taking over for Coach Cullen in Houston.
Okay, so there's three coaches. There'll be three Black coaches now.
And no, it'll only be two.
Oh,
that'll
be two. Okay.
Yeah. The person who took over Brian Flores, I can't remember. He's a white gentleman, right?
No, it's Mike McDaniel, and he actually you know what? I'm going to share this.
Go ahead.
There's a statement that I can read that he states about his color. I think that's really important, because you think he's white, correct? And someone else mentioned in an article that he was white. They had to retract that and state his true identity as he expresses himself with it. Since we're talking about self-expression, I think that's really important. But I just want to make that point for people who aren't familiar in the audience about NFL, what's going on. First, they have 32 teams in the mm-hmm. NFL approximately, yeah. And not one owner. In order to have an ownership of a team, the other owners have to get together to allow that.
Yep.
So basically the owners haven't gotten together to think to allow another team or allow an African-American or I want to say an Asian-American. I think some people are half partners, but not fully in ownership of any NFL team. Mm-hmm. Also, the teams, 70% of the league members are African American.
Yep. 70%.
And so when you look at two African American coaches of 32 teams, that's not even
10%.
90%. And we're 70% of the league as members.
And zero owners.
And zero owners. So I just want to put that real. And so I remember when they were talking about Oscars, the Oscars, because, you know, that's part of self-expression, you know, drama and creating writing. Oscars so white, NFL ownership so white, right? So it's really awful in that regard. But I wanted to...
Now, it's going to be interesting. Watch what happens in Denver. See what happens in Denver. See if they can get Robert Smith to buy the Denver Broncos. I'm not sure he'll do it, but some people are trying to get him to at least look into it.
Wow, I didn't even know about that. I'm glad you brought that up. Very interesting that is.
If he did do it, it'll be great. I don't know if he has traction to want to do it, but if he did do it, it would be really, really interesting.
Okay, so I have up here, I just brought it up. Now, let me make sure we're back to understanding. Mike McDaniels is the new incoming head coach of the Miami Dolphins. Huh? The former head coach, who was African-American, Brian Flores.
From Brooklyn.
He's fired, and he's now having a class action lawsuit against the whole entire league, the NFL league. So, but McDaniel, we're talking about self-expression. I want you to listen. I'm going to read his words verbatim. Okay. They're not too long. And I want you to tell me how comfortable you are even hearing his self-expression.
Okay.
So the question that that he was asked at a press conference was, your ethnicity has been a topic of conversation since your hiring. I wanted to ask, how has your experience growing up as how you identify, how has that experience been? And do you think getting a job like this sets an example for more people just like you who have the same life experiences? That's the question. Here's his answer. Yeah, it's been very odd, to tell you the truth. This idea of identifying as something, I think people identify me as something, but I identify as a human being. And my dad is Black, so whatever you want to call it, I know there's a lot of people with a shared experience. It's weird that it comes up because I've just tried to be a good person, and I think my background opens my eyes a little bit. I don't have any real experience with racism. I think you identified me as something close to, I don't know. But I know my mom experienced it when she married my dad. I know my dad experienced it and that it's in my family. I guess that makes me a human being that can identify with other people's problems. What do you think about this self-expression? ethnicity.
Yeah, it was like, you could almost think, when they had that the checklist about race, you know, Black, white, Hispanic, non-Hispanic, other, decline the answer.
Yeah.
I can see you saying decline the answer or other. Decline the answer or other.
Decline the answer.
It's either one of those two, and I think decline the answer might be that. So that's who I am. I'm like, but you know what might happen with him? As you were saying, even just the first part, he lived a sheltered life where his parents shielded him a lot from that. Because when he was saying, he didn't sound like...
From what? You said from that.
From any backlash. Like, you're half this, you're half that. It sounds, if he heard it, it wasn't that grotesque. Because he didn't sound like he suffered too much from any backlash. And then chances are, they might have lived in a white neighborhood where he looked more white than Black, and so
that looks white. Everyone's thinking he is.
So my point came that he probably didn't have to suffer as much. Now I tell you, it'd be interesting to know. I'm gonna find out his age because when I went to Minnesota, I'll never forget this, Kim.
Well, before you tell that story, I want to just say we have about 2 minutes left, and I kind of wanted to let people know that his answer was, like you were saying, disconcerting.
Yeah.
It's like he was raised without a good foundation of his heritage, of his culture. That's what Black History Month is destined to do. Not just to show Black culture to Black people, but to all people so that we don't have to be confused, right? And I want you to kind of end this discussion, and you can state what you were going to, but in your discussion with how this book, your book, can be helpful to for that cause.
Well, my book, from a, like I said, from a social and emotional perspective, will help breed confidence. There are, I got to give credit to this, Sir Francis Bacon came up with, I believe it was in 1597, Knowledge is Power.